Hello and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast for the first time in 2023. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive catalogue of films brings together cinema from around the globe going back over a century. The full library is over 6,000 titles strong, including horrors from The Wicker Man to Train to Busan, comedies such as Delicatessen and Whiskey Galore, and modern favourites such as Mulholland Drive and the peerless Paddington 2. We're going to do our very best to explore it all in this podcast. The story so far? Well, we've gone from Apocalypse Now and John Carpenter to the French New Wave and a bit of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And most recently, it feels so far away now, a bit of festive fare as well. But now we're in the throes of winter. It's chilly, the coffee's having to work overtime, and that means we're looking at some vintage ghost stories. We're going to be exploring a film that marries up weird golf shots, a smash mirror, and a ventriloquist dummy with the Ealing Studios portmanteau horror Dead of Night. And we're also going to dive into the much-loved ghost story Queen of Spades, the recent beneficiary of a sparkling 4K restoration. Here's a taster of Queen of Spades, just to get you in the mood.
Don't cry out! Don't be alarmed! Please, don't be alarmed! I don't mean you any harm. I've come to ask a favour of you. That's all. Favour. It'll cost you nothing. But to me, it will bring happiness for the rest of my life.
Pamela Hutchinson is my guest to talk about these films. She's a freelance writer, a critic, a film historian, and admirably, she helped to shave the budget off the podcast a little by choosing tap water rather than coffee. So that's a good start, Pamela. Hello.
Hello. Then I changed my mind and had coffee instead.
Let's gloss over that. I mean, people don't know that, and we can comfortably gloss over it. So we like to start with a little bit of a film-related fact with each of our guests. And I've got here that you picked your sixth form college because it was next to Ealing Studios. Is that correct?
It is entirely correct, and it changed my life. When I was about 17, my family moved to London, and I had to pick somewhere to continue my A-levels. And, I mean, how do you pick? This college was next door to Ealing Studios, and they told me I'd have to study something called film studies because of a clash in my timetable. So, yeah, that led to something. I also met my husband there, so really it was a good choice.
Okay. But if you hadn't been into Ealing films, your educational path would have been very, very different.
Well, I probably would have gone to Hounslow.
Okay. And well,
there's no film connection there, apart from Bend
just
It Like
edit
Beckham.
In a very long silence. Well, I'm glad you went to Ealing.
Thank you.
All worked well. We're here to talk about Queen of Spades and Dead of Night, an extraordinary double bill we've picked here of basically 1940s British ghost stories. Can you give us just some historical context for the pair of them before we really get into them? Because as I understand it, it was pretty much illegal to even make horror films in the UK in the first half of the 1940s.
Yeah, there was a sort of ban on production of horror films during the war. And also there's like a wider historical context, which is that in Britain in the 30s and 40s, the thing that everyone loved, the things that everyone prized above all was realism. And going into the 40s, you have near realism as well. So there's an art house crowd liked realism too. So ghost stories, horror, fantasy, very much frowned upon.
And so the war ends in 1945. Of course, I don't think that's a massive exclusive. And I'm fascinated by the fact that Dead of Night comes out in 1945.
Well, you know, I mean, the Ealing Studios could do pretty much whatever they wanted. They started making it in January 1945. So they were bad boys. You know, Michael Balcon at Ealing, he ruled that studio from the pub. Not that I ever went to the pub when I was a student, obviously.
Understood.
And decisions got made. And this film is quite pivotal in the history of Ealing Studios. It was a real showcase for a lot of their directors.
Let's set the other film we're going to talk about up as well. So who or what is the Queen of Spades? That's a nice, easy softball question for you.
Well, as I'm sure you've read Alexander Pushkin's original story, The Queen
every
of Spades.
Night, every night.
Yeah, so I mean, it was actually a quite well-filmed story already. There'd been some silent film versions. Not that the people who made this film necessarily had seen that. It's a British film with a Russian producer, Anatole de Grunwald, And it was directed by one of the most interesting figures from British film history, which is Thorold Dickinson, the man with a cursed film career. And as so often happened in this film, you know, someone else was set to direct it, and Thorold Dickinson came along. Apparently he was given the script on Tuesday, sort of met the cast on Sunday and was filming the following Monday. That's his story, and we stick to that. It's a ghost story about a man who sells his soul to the devil, basically, to win at cards. And I don't want to spoil the end, but yeah, it's a very scary film.
Believe me, there are things to be seen the eye has not seen, and things to be heard the ear has not heard. Who knows what you may learn from it? Or you might end up by gaining a fortune or losing your precious soul.
You said cursed film career there, and you've just given us a little bit of a hint, because Thorold Dickinson didn't make as many films as perhaps someone of his reputation now you would have expected to have done. Can you just tell us a little bit about him and why his career was quite so cursed?
I don't know, maybe he made a deal with the devil, but he started out as an editor, and then he got these opportunities to direct, often when someone else had vacated the director's chair, as in this case. You know, he made a film, like one of his best films, which he wouldn't have made this one without, is Gaslight. Mm. Gaslight was famously suppressed by MGM. This is the British version of the Patrick Hamilton play starring Anton Walbrook. When the American studio wanted to remake it with Ingrid Bergman and Charles Boyer, they made sure all prints were destroyed. So for years, we weren't able to see his version at all. It was only relatively recently discovered. And so his name has also been a bit lost. It's people like Martin Scorsese who've really championed him and said, this guy, this intellectual, the first professor of film in Britain, you know, at the Slade, he was actually making these wonderful films, and we should dig them out and have a look at them.
As I understood it, he stepped in for, it was Rodney Ackland who co-wrote Queen of Spades, or the screenplay of this version, who fell foul of the producers.
Yeah, I think they had very different ideas about where it go. Thorold Dickinson got on board and immediately found things he didn't like in the script, or so he says. So he reckons that he was not only picking up this very expensive film at the last minute after they'd lost a week of production, but rewriting it as he went along. So he was doing quite a lot of development as he was shooting.
Losing a week of a production is a heavy burden if it's a high budget, high profile film. But this was a low budget horror, really, wasn't it?
Oh, we did have quite a big budget, even though Welland Studios were right next to the train tracks, which doesn't work that well for making a film, as anyone who's tried to record a podcast in an office building will understand.
Who, you know, would do that?
Who would do such a thing? So they had to have a man on the roof to tell them when the train was coming so they could stop. But yeah, they had these really lavish sets designed by Oliver Messel, who had worked in film before, especially as a costume designer, but he was a big theatre designer. He'd done the big Sleeping Beauty ballet, you know, in 1946, which was like the big statement of British culture coming back after the war. So this was always going to look beautiful, but what Thorold Dickinson brought to the beautiful sets crammed into this tiny studio was this atmosphere.
You mentioned Oliver Messel there, and it's fascinating that his models of those sets are still very much intact.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful to see, because I think they probably felt like they were working on a model set. A lot of the time, there was the whole story about bringing in the Countess's coach. There's a Countess in this film, and she has a coach. And just bring in the coach and the horses was almost filled up the entire soundstage.
Can you imagine? Horses on a soundstage is most people's version of hell, isn't it?
I think they managed to move just a few rolls of the wheel before stop again.
The classic British fantasy film Kroll struggled with horses on a soundstage. It's not the most obvious double bill, but, you know, we'll recommend anything. That's fine.
We're all about double bills today.
We've talked about the people behind the camera. Can you tell us a little bit about the people in front of it as well?
Well, I hope you have 3 hours for me to talk about the greatness of Anton Walbrook, one of the most fascinating people from British film history of this mid-period. He was German, and he'd been working in the German film industry, and he was a real matinee idol. Now, if you think of Anton Walbrook, he looks slightly different in this film, because at some point in the 1930s, he starred in a film where they asked him to put on a moustache, and he realised that he looked devilishly handsome, which is the only way to describe it. In this film, playing this sort of rather desperate character, he's got no moustache. So from the beginning, it's Anton Walbrook, but unhinged, which is a great way to start a film. He's got quite shaggy hair and he's got no moustache. So if you've seen him in, you know, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, or you've seen him in The Red Shoes as Boris Lermontov, you know, you'll see this very dapper, controlled man. British audiences would have seen him in Gaslight too, which is very much the kind of thing. He often played characters that were a little bit dubious and enigmatic and kind of villainous, really, when he got into Britain. He started out by like charming us all by playing Prince Albert a couple of times, and then he went full into the anti-hero mode.
I want the secret of the cards. The three cards. The names of the three cards. Please.
Can you imagine the promotion of this film in the Twitter era? I mean, Anton Walbrook, but now with no moustache. I mean, that'd be viral, wouldn't it?
You can just imagine the teenage girls tearing up their posters. Anton Walbrook has this charisma that just can't be taught. He always looks like he's locking eyes on you when you watch him on screen. And so in this film, where he has this very megalomaniac, very dangerous, very dark purpose, and one of the things he does in the film, of course, is seduce someone heartlessly, because he doesn't care for her at all. You do feel like you're being led into dangerous, murky waters by this man. From the get-go in this film, you know that this is a particular Anton Walbrook performance.
Have mercy on me, Holy Virgin. Have mercy on me.
The other hugely striking performance is the Countess.
Yes, Edith Evans. Edith Evans, who was a renowned stage actress. Yeah. Now, you know, if you listen to Thorold Dickinson, he will say this was her first film. He coaxed this performance out of her. And now people always forget about the silent era. So here we have another 2 hours of me ranting about that.
Yeah, yeah, help yourself.
But she had appeared in films in the silent era. This was one of her first talkies. And then she went on to have another sort of late flourishing of her career after this. It was also Yvonne Mitchell who plays her ward. It was one of her first films too. So apparently Anton Walbrook was on set very generous with both these actresses, sort of coaxing them through it. But they're both very striking. The scene in this film. Now, there are many scenes in this film that are incredibly memorable, but the scene in which Anton Walbrook and the Countess and a gun, I can't even begin to tell you what happens because it's too much of a spoiler, but you would believe that this man could have this effect on this woman. And you would believe that this woman has these terrible, terrible secrets that she has essentially hollowed out her soul in pursuit of material gain.
The secret is connected with some terrible sin. That's it, isn't it? But I make a bargain with you. Tell me your secret and I take your sin upon my soul. Do you hear me? I mean it. A bargain. I'll take your sin upon my own soul.
She appears very old on screen as well. I looked up and she just wasn't. She was nowhere near that age.
There's a lack of vanity there because the whole film is so beautiful. And actually her kind of Miss Havisham-like kind of dishevelment works really well within this very crowded compositions, baroque mise-en-scène that it has. Oh, no, I said mise-en-scène. Do I have to go now?
Well, you're going to have to surrender your coffee and switch back to tap water. But, you know, that's the price you pay. It was worth it. It was worth it. And so the film itself... It's really chilling, even through, perhaps especially through modern eyes.
It's really hard not to fall victim to the idea that old films are quaint, that old scary films can't really be scary, you know, if it doesn't have special effects, if it doesn't have the jump scares, you know. But this film genuinely gets you in the pit of your stomach. Mm. It's very terrifying. There's a great sound design. The score is very sparse. Anton Walbrook is just unhinged. There's a sense that Thorold Dickinson was quite often able to create in his films of this enclosed world. You are locked in the room with this man's madness and his pursuit of power. And when the ghost comes, and, you know, is that a spoiler? You know, it's a ghost story.
I'll send the complaints to you. That's fine.
Well, you never see the ghost, but you hear the ghost. And it's this very strange use of sound, which I remember thinking almost was something really clever. And it turns out that they got all the wind noises from Scott at the Antarctic and played them on top of each other.
No.
Yeah. When you find out what the snow is, then you're really going to lose your lunch. Do you want to know what the snow is?
Of course we want to know what the snow is.
So it's shredded perspex, which scratched everyone's skin. But it's not any old perspex. It's perspex that had been taken and shredded from the windows of crashed German aircraft. So the war... The horrors of the war are raining down on the set of this film.
Good grief. Yeah. I mean, I've heard stories of old films that used asbestos, but I mean, this is a new one.
Very thrifty.
Well, assuming no lawsuits afterwards, that would probably offset the three. Because you talked briefly about where this was actually shot, because the film is set in St. Petersburg, but yeah. It was actually shot in an old shredded wheat factory.
Yeah, in a studio in Welland Garden City.
Oh, glamour.
Yeah, well, you know what, the thing about movies is it's non-stop glamour. Always.
Well, I like the person on the roof who's warning them. Imagine, are they in the credits? Man on top of shredded wheat factory.
Do you think it would be like assistant sound director or something? Yeah, a man on top of the factory warning them the 920 from Halifax is going to come along and it's going to ruin your beautifully atmospheric scene between Anton Walbrook and the divinely beautiful Yvonne Mitchell. And, you know, your evocation of 19th century St. Petersburg is going to be suddenly a little bit mid-century Britain. But, you know, I mean, the thing is, you can never, when you have historical films, you can never divorce the time that it was made from the time that it's set. There's always this wonderful combination of the two. And if you have seen Queen of Spades long enough to find yourself thinking about the trains outside the studio, you really have seen it too many times, because, I mean, it's impossible to think about that when you watch this film. When I see Anton Walbrook on screen, something happens to me and then I sort of forget where I am and who I am and what my values are. Mashinka!
Queen of Spades has been lavishly restored, but I mean, one of the interesting things about the team who did restore it, I read an interview with an old friend of mine, Sarah Cook. She talked about how the restoration team found the camera work felt so modern.
Yeah, there's some really strange camera angles, there's really strong effects on the screen. I think it's interesting that people who know about these things said, you know, modern camera work. Dickinson himself said he felt like he was using silent film techniques.
Interesting.
There's this kind of vignetting and gauzing, and there's all these very, very tight compositions. There's a lot in each frame of this film. It's very picturesque. I'd love to know exactly what they mean by modern filming techniques, but I think perhaps maybe getting so close to the actors feels more modern. We sort of do think of that sort of like drawing room scene when we think of older films where the camera's pulled back so you can see everyone. But yeah, you're right in amongst the madness here.
The other thing about Queen of Spades, before we move off it, is, I mean, this was a lost film. It came back in 2009, and you mentioned Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, Martin Scorsese is one of the people who's always long championed this film. Yeah, it was lost. This is one of the many ways in which Thorold Dickinson isn't really the big name that he should be. And now I think he's quite fashionable to drop his name. So, you know, if you want to hang out with Wes Anderson and Martin Scorsese, tell them that you've seen Queen of Spades and you thought that it was really scary.
The other part of the double bill we've picked here is Dead of Night, which we touched on just before. And Dead of Night was made a few years earlier. And when I think Ealing, I don't really think horror.
No, it's really interesting because when you think about Ealing, you might think of some star vehicles, probably think of war films, but of course you think of the Ealing comedies. And that's probably what 17-year-old me was thinking about. This is a film that has the lightness of touch of those comedies, a sort of wry look at British society, but it's very much a horror. If The Queen of Spades is a psychological horror, this is more of a kind of psychoanalytical horror, you know, that kind of 1940s trend of wondering what's going on in everyone's psyche. It's a portmanteau film. It's got how many stories? It's got 5 stories and the overarching story. And because it's got 4 directors and 6 stories, I think.
Well, I don't worry, it's not a maths test. The stories within it, it's not unusual. We've got a framing device setting it up and they're all in a room telling their stories. And then we break off into these individual tales.
Yeah, so Basil Dearden, who a lot of people will know as a sort of big Ealing name, directed the overarching story, which itself is a horror story. An architect goes to an old country cottage in Kent, and as soon as he gets there, he's immediately completely freaked out because he's seen this cottage in his recurring nightmare that he has. He recognises all the people that are drinking tea in the drawing room, and he knows that certain things are going to happen. Someone's going to leave, someone's going to arrive, and that he knows then the horror will begin. And if you're at this point thinking this is a quaint Ealing film, I won't be scared at the end, I have another thing coming for you.
It does frame it at first in a really quaint way, though. This just feels like a nice old film.
You're Elliot Foley.
That's right. So glad you were able to come. Let's have your bag. And put the car away afterwards.
And then they even sort of say, well, I guess it'd be time for tea.
Do you take milk and sugar? Milk and sugar, Mr. Craig. Milk and sugar, Mr. Craig.
And they come in and everyone introduces themselves and everyone laughs off the idea that horror exists.
I've seen you in my dreams. Sounds like a sentimental song, doesn't it? I've dreamt about you over and over again, Doctor.
The reason we know the horror is definitely going to happen is because we don't just have British stiff upper lips. We have a psychiatrist in the room who says, oh, no, people think that they've seen ghosts, but there's no such thing.
And he's a proper movie psychiatrist.
Yes, he is. The Germanic accent and everything. Absolutely. Frederick Falk.
That hardly turns you into a mental case. After all, recurring dreams are quite common.
But how did I come to dream about you? And I've never set eyes on you in my life.
It's all about whether or not you can believe what you see. And for example, this psychiatrist does not believe the ghost stories that everyone is about to tell. Everyone in that room has got a story about a brush with the macabre or supernatural, and he will poo-poo every single one of them. until it gets really serious.
So tell me your favourite of those stories.
My favourite of the stories is probably The Haunted Mirror. So this is directed by Robert Hamer, who went on to have this like wonderful run of doing Pink Strings and Ceiling Works, Kind Hearts and Coronets, and It Always Rains on Sunday. So The Haunted Mirror stars Googie Withers as this dashingly modern young girl who gets engaged to a lovely chap, and she buys him an antique mirror for their apartment. It goes in the bedroom. Yes, there is a subtext here. And when he looks into the mirror, he sees another room. He sees a sort of gothic mansion with a fireplace. And he gets obsessed with this thing that he sees in the bedroom. He can't stop thinking about it. He's drawn into it. He feels like that world's real. Of course, we will discover that the mirror has been witness to a terrible murder, and that what's being unleashed here is the memories of this old murder and the old sexual jealousy that the former owner of the mirror had. It's brilliant. It's a perfect way of expressing that people had sick, disturbed thoughts in 1945.
I would concur.
It's also kind of a bit like expressing how much British cinema at the time tried to make everything realist and modern and on this sort of calm, even keel. And really, there were Powell and Pressburgers and Gainsboroughs everywhere just throwing up bits of horror and fantasy and gothic and romance that kind of counteracted this idea that we were all a steady ship. So you have this other horror film sort of bursting into this story. It works brilliantly. It still scares me. Having watched this film so much as a teenager, I watched it again the other day and I was sort of creeped out.
I'll take a bullet for the segment of the film that's probably the least liked.
Came here to talk about art cinema, and what do we get?
We get novelty golf shots.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a golfing segment directed by Charles Crichton, I think did that.
So even
surely
comedian.
Surely you can't be unhappy with my selection of a bit of Charles Crichton golf.
What you have here is you've got a story by H.G. Wells, you've got two characters from one of Hitchcock's scariest films, The Lady Vanishes, Charters and Caldecott.
Yes.
And we have a story about two men who are inseparable on the golf course. And in love. They fall in love with the same girl.
I've got it.
What? We'll play for her.
Tomorrow morning. 18 holes.
Match play.
The loser to vanish from the scene.
Forever.
Pretty fair, then.
Of course. Why didn't we think of it sooner?
To see the bit that I zero in on, because I'm a very spoiler-free man, is the special effect of a golf shot. Is quite off the chart, I think. I'm not a golfer, but I'm a student of novelty golf shots in the movies. And so it's this and Tin Cup, really.
May the Lord have mercy on your handicap.
It's interesting where it's positioned in the film as well, because it does almost feel like it's letting a little bit of the air out and letting us have a bit of fun before it ramps it all up again and they bring that ventriloquist out.
I mean, I can barely talk about the ventriloquist.
Oh, let's talk about the ventriloquist then.
You know, BFI South Bank has this lovely cafe on the river, and at one point they had this huge blown up image of the ventriloquist dummy from this film, and you just walk in and get instantly traumatised. So Michael Redgrave plays a ventriloquist. And he has this rather sardonic dummy who in the act says all these awful things. Like, it goes from banter and it goes full to, like, he would be cancelled on Twitter straight away. You know, the terrible, terrible things.
Ventriloquist Bants.
Dummy Bants.
Dummy Bants, okay.
You're sort of teamed up with him, aren't you?
Him? My good man, think nothing of it. I'm just about through with that cheap ham anyway.
Oh. But it turns out the banter masks a more sinister side to this dummy.
It does, though. It's chilling.
It's the uncanny, the dummy, the doll that talks and seems to have a will of its own. And the will of the dummy's own is all to do with murder, because it always is in this film. So, yeah, you know, there's a jealousy between ventriloquists. Michael Redgrave himself falls from great height from being a successful ventriloquist, which is not a word you want to say very often in several sentences. And we end up in jail cell and we end up with the psychiatrist and terrible things are unleashed.
You wouldn't run out on me now. I can't believe it. You wouldn't do that to me.
Oh, wouldn't I? Wouldn't I? Wouldn't I?
Anyone who's even seen a still of this dummy probably, like, gets chills. It might be the most terrifying of the stories, I think. Especially because we come back to it in the end.
It's the most famous, I think. That's certainly the only one I'd heard of before I put the film on for the first time.
Oh,
I didn't know the golf was in it.
No, nobody thinks about the golf. Just you.
And, well, off the back of this podcast, the BFI South Bank at this moment is blowing up a massive picture of the novelty golf shot to put on its wall.
Yeah, do you know what? I mean, I'm not really so anti the golf because we've started with a lot of premonitions of death and really scary stories. So it does give you that breather before the film gets incredibly terrifying.
Is there anything else in Dead of Night we should look out for, do you think?
So we've got the Cavalcanti stories, so we've got the Christmas party. Two young teenagers go off to play sardines together, which I think we know what that means.
No idea. Could you explain that to us, Pamela?
Sardines is a kind of game of hide and seek where you might cram into small places with someone else. And so this girl and boy go off there and... Anyway,
and cram.
They cram. Okay. And then, of course, the young lady, she meets a young boy who's terrified that his sister's going to kill him.
I'm not frightened. I'm not frightened. Oh, please hold me tight. Oh, hold me tight.
So Cavalcanti was, of course, like this great art house director who'd been working in the GPO film unit in Britain. So he'd obviously been working on pure realism. And he comes out with all his French and Brazilian flair in this segment.
One little thing I found with Dead of Night as well is I didn't realise it was part shot by Douglas Slocum.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, you know, this was obviously a real popular hit, but it's a really classy film. The nature of the film with the little stories and things makes you think it's going to be a bit of a throwaway bit of entertainment, maybe very populist entertainment, but it's done beautifully. Beautiful performances, great set design, even... You know, we didn't talk about the hearse driver. I don't really need to tell you that the story about hearse driver is scary, but, you know, it's very sinister.
Put it this way. If you're looking out the window and someone's looking up at you with a particular facial look near a hearse, that's probably a good time to pack your bags and peg it.
Also, if you are lucky enough to see Dead of Night on the big screen, don't take the bus home.
Why have these two films in particular resonated of this era? And would you say they're more respected now than they were then?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say that Queen of Spades wasn't respected. It played at the Cannes Film Festival, notoriously divided everyone. The people who thought, oh, this is terrible because it's not near realism. The people who said, oh, thank God, it's something different. Obviously, it's lost its sort of sheen and then regained it. When we think about horror and British cinema, there's lots that's happened recently. It's very exciting. We think about the golden era of Hammer horror, which comes after this. Officially, we didn't have horror in the 40s and the 50s. And, you know, it's so great to see that actually we did. And people like Powell and Pressburger weren't entirely alone. You know, we brought Hitchcock into the world and we let him go, but we carried on scaring people at the cinema.
So before we let you go, Pamela, one of the things we love to do on this podcast is to get our guests to dive into the Studio Canal catalogue for us and pick a double bill. And we forewarned you this was going to happen. So tell us your double bill. Tell us what we should be watching and why.
Well, we've already had one double bill. So I sort of let that inspire me. I thought, let's bring on the story of British cinema like a little bit further on. And I didn't find this by accident, but how about the year of 1963, Philip Larkin year?
Okay.
And I want a double bill of London set films from 1963. So I've got my West End Boys and East End Girls double bill, which is The Servant, Joseph Losey, and Sparrows Can't Sing by Joan Littlewood.
Introduce us to Sparrows Can't Sing.
Sparrows Can't Sing is one of my favourite British films, and we are all about female directors, obviously. Joan Littlewood worked in theatre in the East End. Everything she did was very much of the East End. And this film stars a little-known British actress called Barbara Windsor.
I am familiar with some of her work.
Sparrows can't sing.
And this is a drama set in the East End. Her bloke has come back from a long time at sea. I think in the original story, he'd been in the Clink. He comes back, and not only has she moved on, but basically his house has been knocked down. She's now living in a tower block. So it's not just about the story of them picking up their relationship. It's about the transformation of the whole East End, where all the old housing, which you might think of slum housing, has been knocked down and being replaced by the sort of modern world. So it's the East End on a precipice, you know, between sort of its like hipster enclave it is now and the old world of the East End and the social system and, you know, everything about the kind of community of the East End. This is the kind of film that had its premiere in the East End. I think it had subtitles on its US release. You know, it's entirely in Cockney.
Does she scream, "Get out my pub," at any point?
No, but she gets up to all sorts of things. Barbara Windsor, I could not tell you how much I love her in this film. She's delightful. She looks like a little sparrow herself. And she's tottering along with her pram with a baby in. And she has this very, very sexualized relationship with her ex. And it's very heavy and occasionally a little bit violent. There are scenes in a pub. There is a showdown in a pub. You will be very delighted to hear. It's an excellent film.
Don't you tell me what to do.
I will tell you what to do.
You can't tell me what to do.
I can tell you what to do.
I won't want to know.
You will when I finish with you.
Yeah, well, I'll finish with you.
Well, another excellent film is Joseph Losey's The Servant. For those not familiar, just introduce us to that, please.
The Servant surely needs no introduction, but whereas Barrows Can't Sing is set on this kind of architectural urban planning scale, this is all within one house in the West End, just off the King's Road in Chelsea. And the protagonist of the film is a rich young chap who isn't really very good at being an establishment gent. He doesn't really know how to fulfill that role. He's a bit feckless, can't really get married, can't really sort of settle on a job. He hires a butler to come and work in his house. That butler is played by Dirk Bogarde, which could tell you everything you need to know about how this film is going to play out. It's a very sinister film, and it is about one old social order in Britain being replaced by a new one. There's jazz, there's sex, there's devious schemes. If you liked Parasite even a tiny bit, you're going to love this film. Dirk Bogarde's famous line is, you know, I'm a gentleman's gentleman, but you are no gentleman. He'll tell you everything you need to know about why Britain in the 60s was a bit twisted. Partner it with performance, partner it with Parasite, partner it with Paris Can't Sing, and you'll get the best palate chaser, honestly, and the best palate cleanser. But yeah, I really love this film. It's absolutely terrifying in its own way.
Nobody talks to me like that.
Do you know what you are?
I know
you.
All about your
sort. You're a peasant.
Peasant, I'll get out of the way. I'll show you what I am. I'll tell you what I am. I'm a gentleman's gentleman, and you're no bloody gentleman.
Pamela Hutchinson, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You can stream Dead of Night, The Servant and Sparrows Can't Sing on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Apple TV and Prime Video right now. And that sparkling 4K restoration of Queen of Spades has just arrived on DVD and digital, as well as on Blu-ray 2 for the very first time. 2023, then, is going to be a busy year in the world of Studio Canal. And here's just a taste of some of the treats coming your way. Making its debut at this year's Sundance Film Festival is Cat Person, the new film directed by Booksmart co-writer Susanna Fogel and based on the viral short story by Kristen Rupenian. The new film stars Amelia Jones and Nicholas Braun, and we're looking forward to telling you more about it.
Bye.
What's Love Got to Do with It, headlined by Lily James and Shahzad Latif, is heading to cinemas shortly as well.
I'm getting married.
You are?
Who's the lucky lady?
Don't know yet.
What do you mean?
I'm getting an arranged marriage. What, assisted marriage? That's what we're calling it these days.
Penned by Jemima Khan and directed by Shakir Kapoor, this witty romance is in UK cinemas at the end of February. A reminder, too, that Evil Dead Rise will take the classic horror franchise from the countryside to the city this April. Produced by Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell, the latest trailer has just been released, and we're going to be talking about it more in an episode or two's time. That's it for this episode of Studio Canal Presents. We'll be back next month for another dive into the Studio Canal catalogue. In the meantime, to find out more about Studio Canal films and the Apple TV and Prime Video channel, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. I'm off to put all the lights on, check the doors, and make sure there are no ghosts around here. I'll see you soon for the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Ta-ta for now.